All right, welcome back to E75. This is lecture 8, JavaScript continued. So one announcement, pre-proposals, as some of you probably did not realize, were actually due earlier today. But because I didn't make an explicit mention of it and because it's been a few weeks since we actually handed you that document, why don't we just give a blanket forgiveness to anyone who didn't even realize that was happening, and we'll just accept them by this coming Monday. But the sooner the better. The purpose of the pre-proposal, per the final project spec, is just to get people thinking. And from the smile, okay, I saw one of these, literally. So that's okay. So the purpose of the pre-proposal, per the spec, which is on the projects page, is really just to get folks thinking and to give you a chance to get a little bit of feedback from the teaching fellows as to whether or not you might be biting off too much, too little, whether or not your ideas are consistent with what the course expects. But the spec itself is very general, very welcoming of projects in most any direction, so long it's somehow inspired by what we've been doing in this course. Don't think you need to do something that combines XHTML with CSS, with SQL, with PHP, with MySQL, with every piece of jargon we've used in the course, even just one piece of it. If you take it and run with it, would make us happy, for, most likely. So keep that in mind. And those for those of you from afar tuning in here, do realize you are quite welcome and encouraged to join us on the 21st of December for the CS Fair, which will be joint with the class across the hall, Digital Photography. A fun way to kind of climax the course together and get to know each other, if only for the last time. Any questions about the final project? So blanket extension on the pre-proposal till next Monday. But again, sooner the better, because it's really meant for your benefit more than it is for ours. The proposal itself is due later in November, and that's meant to be your stake in the ground as to what you want to do and how you plan to do it. So consult the PDF with any questions. All right, so today is ultimately about finishing up our conversation about JavaScript, believe it or not. Last week we spent a bit of time introducing some of the examples, some of the syntax rather, by way of a number of examples. Tonight we'll look at some other examples, again using JavaScript, but this time we're actually going to use Ajax underneath the hood. But we're pretty much going to abstract away the details of Ajax. We'll define what it is, but we won't get our hands dirty with Ajax itself, because that's what we'll do next week, and actually implement some Ajax interfaces from the ground up. But today we'll dabble in them by way of this API, which is the one you'll dabble with for your last project, Project 3, which is now available on the course's website. And this has you implement a mashup. By this we mean take Google Maps, take Google News, and mash them together in some way per the spec. The interface you're ultimately going to have is going to have a Google Map embedded in it like this, pretty familiar interface, but instead of just having one marker, such as the thing you're searching for, you're going to have several markers, each one of which is going to represent some news from a particular city that's within view on the screen. Well, how is this going to work? You'll have a text box. You'll search for something like Beverly Hills, California. Your interface will have to whisk the user away to that particular location in the United States so that what appears in the map all of a sudden is Beverly Hills' area. And then you'll have to sprinkle that map with a few markers. Each of those represents the largest city within view based on 2000 census data. And when clicked, each of those markers will trigger a little cartoon bubble, a la Google Maps. And inside of that will be current events from RSS feeds provided by Google News. So to tie all this together, this is the staff's implementation of this, cs75.net/news. And you'll find that we have precisely this interface. We kept it simple. Text box up top, interface down below. And if I click, for instance, on this marker here, there is all the news for Cambridge, Mass. 02138. If I click over here, I've got some news for Somerville, Mass. If I do the search I promised, how about just 90210? I know two zip codes in this world, my own and this one. And if I give it a second, notice the little progress bar up top right. Looks like there's three major cities in this area. I'm going to go ahead and click this marker here, and voila, Beverly Hills, California, 90209, which is the zip code corresponding to the search I found. Now, how do you figure out what the largest cities are within view? Well, we, at some point last year, did a little bit of Googling, and we searched for something like zip code list, because we wanted to get a whole bunch of zip codes so that we could allow our students to do searches. We ideally wanted some population data so that we could determine which cities are largest, and we literally came across this website here, zipcodes.com. So we click this link here, and we got this website here, which has all these pictures of shrink wrap boxes, but you can't actually buy a shrink wrap box from them. All you do is download the data, but they have a number of different packages, and we did some poking around, and we realized, let's see, US zip code database. I think I clicked over here at the time. This brought me to a page like this. Wow, a lot of different versions of this. I skimmed the various fields, and we ended up buying, on behalf of everyone in the course, the $79.95 package, which includes, among other things, population data, which the cheaper package, unfortunately, did not. So this allowed us to download, as the PDF will tell the same story, a zip file containing an Excel file or containing a CSV file or even a Microsoft Access database. And that was perfect. We threw away the Access database, didn't bother with the Excel file, because CSV is very accessible to any language, PHP among them. So what you'll find is that the spec prescribes that you download or otherwise access the CSV file we bought. It's about 31 megabytes in total, so it's pretty big. You parse it with some PHP, and you import into your own MySQL database the relevant fields. You're not going to need to know, as we joke, for instance, the Hawaiian population in various cities in the United States, so you'll throw some of the data away, but you'll keep things like the total population count and the city and the state and the zip and the name of the actual city. And ultimately, this is going to be an integral part of your mashup, because when a user like myself goes over to the mashup and searches for something like San Francisco, California, enter, some of your data is going to be drawn from Google itself, because Google, you will see, has a geocoding service. So I'll be whisked away by way of Google's own API. But once I'm there, if I need to query for the largest cities, apparently there's only one within view here, just San Francisco, I'm going to need to access that MySQL database. So you'll find that this is a nice culmination to all the stuff we've been doing, because there's going to be a command line portion where you actually have to write a script that imports the data from the CSV file into your own MySQL table, designed somewhat as you see fit. And then there's going to be some JavaScript to wire together the API with a backend PHP file you'll also write that talks to your MySQL database and answers questions of the form, what are the largest cities within view, plus a PHP file, which can be one and the same, that grabs the latest news articles. Well, where are these news articles going to come from? Well, again, same story. I sort of had a vision a couple of terms ago that this general idea would be a nice mashup, so I went fishing on the internet for the various data sets that could make this mashup possible. And I'm telling the story in this way because this is precisely the workflow one might have when tackling a final project. Come up with an idea and then try to figure out what pieces you can wire together to make it happen. So here's Google News. I was curious for something machine readable because I didn't really want to like screen scrape any of this mess. It would be a little too hard and unreliable. So I eventually found my way to advanced news search up here. And then this got interesting because I found this field, location, return only articles about a local area. And then I saw, oh, I can type in a city, state, or zip code, so 02138, enter. And then, as I've been taught in this course, I got curious to look at the URL up here. And even though there's a bunch of stuff that I don't really understand up there, since it's Google's own choice, this got me sort of drooling, because I saw that there was a URL dynamically generated, a parameter called geo, and apparently its value was precisely what I typed in, which meant to me, I can probably mimic these requests. Well, I still don't want to get back a page like this and then screen scrape this, so I was really excited to see that Safari or whatever said, hey, there's an RSS feed underneath here. And in fact, if I poked around a bit more, you'll see that there's an explicit icon down here. So this, too, should get you drooling if you're into this kind of stuff, finding fun data sets. I clicked RSS, and I was led to a page like this. Now, at first glance, this might be a little disappointing because this does not look like XML. This does not look like RSS. But in fact, this is just Safari's rendering of the page. Underneath the hood, it is, in fact, still XML. And let's see if we can actually see that. Sure enough, if I zoom in, there's not much white space in there, but apparently there is an RSS element, a channel element, and then a whole bunch of other stuff, which, thanks to no white space, is all on one line. But no matter. I can parse that using PHP's simple API, a simple XML API. So long story short, we had a vision for this project. We've fished around trying to find the pieces, and now we leave it to you to wire them together. And the spec will walk you through exactly what's expected. So hopefully you'll find this really ties together pretty much everything we've touched on in the course from several different angles. Any questions? No? Yeah, in back.
I actually brought that up in IDEA. Mm-hmm. It actually gives the XML file.
Oh, good. Okay. These are just per browser differences. Firefox, for instance, will show you a screen very similar to what Safari just showed me. I already closed the window. But if you actually view source, it's annoying. They convert it to XHTML underneath the hood, so you can't actually see the RSS unless you disable that feature altogether. Yeah, no, that's good. It's preferable, frankly, for, I think, technical people. Normal people probably prefer it this way. All right, so just a little teaser then. How does one even begin to doing something like this? Well, one of the really exciting things about Google is its freely available APIs, from which, frankly, there's no clear revenue stream, but it works for us because we can make use of these things. So you've probably seen people's websites where they just embed a little Google map to, like, directions to the doctor's office or something like that. Just, it's utilitarian. But it's programmatic, too, this thing. I am able to embed an arbitrarily large or small map in it, and I can clearly manipulate the location of that map using JavaScript. When I typed in something in the search box and clicked go, clearly I was whisked away somewhere else, and that's because using the building blocks from last week, I registered an event handler so that when I click the submit button, I actually intercept that call and I do something with the response. I check for the value of the text field. I hand it to Google via their own JavaScript code. They give me back an answer saying, recenter yourself around this latitude and longitude. I call the appropriate method to do that, and voila. Using Google's as sort of the middleman, can I manipulate this data as well? And then some stuff just works out of the box. Clicking and dragging in this way works just automatically, and that's built into the API. So as you'll see in the spec, using the API is fairly simple. You're going to click a link like this, sign up for a Google Maps API key. It doesn't cost any money or anything like that. You might have to have a Google or Gmail account, but then you just type in your website's URL at the bottom. So that's going to be like project3.foo.com or whatever you registered. You're going to click Generate API Key, and in fact, I can just say project3.foo.com, Generate API Key. And I'm going to have to log in with my account. And what I'd eventually get back here is a little string. And I can show you here. Let me go ahead and log in to our existing version. Let's see. I can do it more quickly. I'm going to go ahead and view my own source code here. What I'm going to get back is a little link like this. So HTTP, maps.google.com. And then if you scroll to the right, there's this field here, key. As you'll see, when you follow Google's own documentation, you're just going to specify or paste in a different value for key. And that authorizes you to make calls to maps.google.com using JavaScript from your particular domain. And for those of you who like to code on your own Macs or PCs locally, whatever API key you get should automatically work for localhost and for 127.0.0.1. You don't need to get two or three different keys, just FYI. So once you have that in place, and we'll walk through a few examples more concretely today, you can begin using the API. The Hello World of Google Maps literally will give you something simple like that, and the Project 3 of Google Maps will give you something much more interactive like we have, and you'll find that the API itself, which we'll only scratch the surface of, is either both rich or overwhelming, depending on how you look at it. Their documentation is wonderful, except, as I think I've said, for the fact that it's all on one page, which is just kind of stupid. So Control F or Command F will be your friend for that exercise. All right, any questions? No? And for final projects, let me draw your attention to one thing, a little code sharing from our other site. I mentioned last week the seminars page on Computer Science 50's website. Well, if you go to a very similar URL, go to wiki.cs50.net/funapis, you for your final projects in this course are welcome to glance at this page for inspiration. What we, the staff of that course, have done, have just kind of poked around and have linked on this site all of the fun APIs out there that we ourselves have used. Google Calendars has an API. Google Checkout, PayPal, if you actually want to earn money from your final projects, by all means, go for it. Learn those APIs, especially if you want them to be useful after the course. Google Finance, and we already know Yahoo kind of has an API. It's a REST-based API, if anything, just very simple URLs. Get back CSV or get back RSS. There's Facebook, there's Google Wave, there's Twitter, which I used for that Twitter example. We have a bunch of Harvard-specific APIs that I've put together over time. JavaScript APIs, which we'll actually look at in part today. Maps, if you want to stray from Google and use Bing or Yahoo. Pretty much everyone has their own thing now. And also particularly fun for final projects in this course, I'll make mention of two things, text marks being one of them. It's relatively easy, it's trivial to send text messages these days from a program. Most every wireless carrier has a domain name that you can use for text messaging. So if a friend of yours has Verizon and their number is 555-1212. You can email them at 555-1212@vtext.com, and that email will actually be sent to Verizon. They will then send it out their SMS gateway, and that will end up at your friend's cell phone, unless they've somehow blocked incoming SMSs. And there's similar domains for all the major carriers. You can Google to find them, tmomail.net, sprintpcs.something, and text.att.net. It's trivial to send SMS messages, but it's also kind of fun that you can do that because you can make very interactive services. The teaching staff of this course is actually reminded via SMS anytime we have office hours, just in case, so that we don't do something stupid like forget. So that's relatively easy to implement. And if you want to receive text messages, can't quite do that on your own. You need a little bit of support if you want proper SMSs to be received. So for instance, I wrote an app a while ago, which I think I've maybe mentioned in passing. It's playfully called Shuttle Boy. But among the features is that you can actually send a text message to it. So if you send a text message, and you can do this at home if you're curious, or during lecture while you're taking a mental break, you can send a text message to 41411, which is what's generally called a short code. These are very expensive short phone numbers that people generally pay thousands of dollars a month for, but that we have subletted some space from, essentially. So if you send a text message to 41411 and then send a message like S-Boy and then the name of an origin stop on campus and a destination stop, Boylston is one, Quad is another, what you'll get back within seconds, hopefully, is in fact a response. And let me see if I can't mimic this just to prove to you that it is in fact this easy. And all of that back end was implemented by me just using a relatively short PHP script. I'm going to go ahead and just do 41411. I'm going to say S-Boy. I'm going to say Boylston, which is a stop outside. Quad, which is a stop up the road. Click send. And if this works, I'll hold the mic, the speaker near my thing here. Give it a second. Cross your fingers. Come on. Come on. Uh-oh. Oh. Oh, I didn't get a message. Oh, I did get it. It didn't beep because I still had SMS open. But it says on my screen, the next shuttle leaves in 5 minutes at 6 p.m. and then at 6:25, 6:30, and 6:50 p.m. So how does that work? And again, this isn't to say all 140 students in the course should go off and do SMS apps, but just to speak to the ease with which you can wire these things together, what I did was as follows. I went to textmarks.com. I clicked the sign up button or whatever it was. I got a free account. I'm not paying for anything. So there actually is a little ad at the bottom of my message, which maybe, in fairness, I'm supposed to read. Powered by textmarks.com, iPhone apps, updates, and more at this various URLs. So what did I do? I registered for an account. They said, pick a special moniker. So I chose S-Boy for Shuttle Boy. And that's how they can sell accounts or just give out free accounts, all that use the same telephone number, 41411, but the messages get routed to different customers, me being one of them. So S-Boy is my little nickname or code or whatever. And then users of mine can pass an arbitrary number of arguments after the word S-Boy, like command line arguments. What TextMarks does for me is they say, all right, we will take all incoming requests that match S-Boy as the first word and then some number of command line arguments afterward, give us the URL of a script, a CGI script, a PHP script, a Perl script, whatever, on the internet that we will just query with this incoming data. And we'll pass in those command line arguments as parameters in the URL. So I wrote a little PHP script that took in two arguments, A and B, for origin and destination. They then passed me these arguments, A and B. So my PHP script is actually relatively simple now. If you assume that I have access to the shuttle data, I do a lookup of stop A, B, the current time. I then come up with an English sentence, which is the response I want to send the user, and I literally just print it to standard output. I don't send HTML, I don't send XML, I just send text. And what TextMarks does is they take that HTTP response, they then send it out their fancy SMS gateway, and voila, it ends up back at my phone within 6 or 7 seconds, it seems. Again, using very basic building blocks. So fun opportunities there as well, especially if you just want something free and easy. So there's plenty more, and I'm sure post on the course's bulletin board if you have others you'd like to recommend. There's so many fun things you can do for a final project, especially if you're struggling to come up with an idea. All right, any questions? Well, we see a lot of fun things come the computer science fair at the end of the semester. All right, so JavaScript. So what's really neat about JavaScript these days is, frankly, how easy it is to do some interesting things. And that's because there are a lot of nice people out there that have put a lot of time into writing libraries that are generally free and of varying levels of documentation. That's sort of the gotcha. So on this list here are pretty much the most popular JavaScript libraries today. It's a little debatable. If you go on Wikipedia, you'll find others, hence my dot, dot, dot there. But these tend to be the ones people talk about and use the most. And I would say probably, just anecdotally, the most popular one probably is jQuery. So there are many, many sites out there that use this thing called jQuery. We won't spend so much time on it in the course because it really is just add some nice syntactic sugar to JavaScript, makes certain things easier, makes them much more succinct to express. For instance, document.getElementById becomes just $, a special function name. It just gets much easier using jQuery to get at data you care about, and there's similar features there as well. So that's very popular. And a final project unto itself, or one big chunk of a final project, might very well be to go learn one of these APIs, use it to integrate, to implement something you might like. Yeah? Good question. Is jQuery the most browser friendly? Not the most, but among the most. So YUI is absolutely up there in terms of robustness and in terms of QA and testing. So I would say, in experience and based on sort of empirical evidence out there on the internet, those two are probably among the best. Okay, so what can you do with these things? Well, I'll turn our attention briefly back to this guy here. So we for the course and we for my own personal projects tend to whip out YUI, mostly because they've given more attention than the others, as best we can tell, to accessibility. And at least on the Harvard campus, that's more important perhaps than in smaller communities where you can maybe sort of assume a certain type of user. So they're in the process of forking off their newest version. One of the downsides to YUI is that it's very verbose. It's even more verbose than some of the built-in JavaScript stuff. I don't mind it so much because it's very clear, to me at least, what I'm doing, because every function is named what it does. And that's useful, at least for someone like me. But at the same time, it's suffered, I think, in adoption because jQuery is literally like the opposite. It's as succinct as things can get. So YUI 3 is an attempt to, you know, hop on that bandwagon and try to appeal to the crowd that really likes the conciseness of jQuery. But what's nice about YUI is you have used their CSS library. So we used sort of, we had you use forcibly for Project Zero just to acclimate you to it, the reset library. And what does this mean? This is this CSS library that you include a little mention of reset min.css or the equivalent in your HTML page. And what that means is that the appearance of your website is, for the most part, normalized across all browsers. So this is huge. And I'll point out one stupid little detail, but that hints at the utility of something like this. One of the examples we'll look at later tonight is this one here. So this is map1.html. You have a printout of this. This is just an embedded div in an otherwise empty web page. And what do you notice around the edge of this map? So there's a bit of white space, certainly bottom right and on the right and the bottom, but also on the left here, it's a little subtle. You can really see it at the top of the page. There's like, it looks like 10 pixels, 5 pixels, something like that of white space. This is not the case in all browsers. Just Safari, by default, puts like a 5 or a 10 or whatever pixel margin around the body of a web page, which may be not a big deal, but if you're trying to implement something that looks identical on all browsers, like, frankly, we were with the staff's own solution, we'd kind of like this to look the same across all browsers. So it's these kinds of stupidities, frankly, that you run into when trying to code for multiple browsers. And so one of the things YUI's reset library does is it gets rid of all of that nonsense. Now, the downside is it also kills things like H1 and H2. So H1 generally looks like what in browsers? How would you describe the behavior of H1? Yeah, so large and bold. So unfortunately, once you use the reset library, you sort of lose a lot of those aesthetics because it literally resets things to nothing. Zero margins, no bold, no largeness, but you can bring some of those things back. So the other popular companion to the reset library is the fonts library. By the fonts library, I mean this. They have figured out, pretty much by trial and error, that if you want to obtain a 12-point font on all major browsers, what you should use is a font size of 93%. If you want a 13-point font, you use a font size in CSS terms of 100% and so forth. So they dealt with all of the headaches of trying to figure out what point size you should use on various browsers. So that, too, is frankly a nice thing. And then finally, the third CSS library in this bucket is the base library. This goes back on top of the reset library and adds back. Is there anything really useful to look at? Yeah, we can look at this. This adds back some stylization. So for H1 and H2 and H3, they become large and larger and largest, or vice versa, and bold again. So this sort of normalizes the behavior that some of you probably were sort of frustrated that disappeared in Project Zero. You can bring some of that back or bring it back yourself. So again, these are especially if you're starting to do real-world projects after this course, and you really just want to eliminate some of the time sinks of like getting things to look the same. These kinds of libraries are wonderful, and this isn't even JavaScript related. So in JavaScript, we have a bunch of utility libraries, which libraries like jQuery provides. We'll start using next week Connection Manager, which so we'll see next week that implementing AJAX queries. It's not terribly hard, but there's a bunch of lines of codes because, frankly, Microsoft decided to do things their own way, at least with IE 6 and 7, so we have to deal with it. So it means your code's like this. Well, there's libraries like YUI and jQuery that may allow you to make AJAX queries using lines of code like this because they take care of all of those nuisances. Just nice things to get yourself up and running faster. And then as you can skim the list here, there's utility libraries for doing bunches of other things as well. But more interesting in the JavaScript world, if you're actually writing user interactive applications are things that the world has started to call widgets. And this is what you get in a lot of these libraries. I pulled up the calendar control last week. Gives you a little pop-up with a calendar. I mean, maybe that alone is sort of a problem set in a course, because getting that right across browsers would really take some time, and it probably wouldn't be all that intellectually stimulating, to be honest, just getting all of that silliness correct. So you grab something like this off the shelf. If you want little pop-ups and dialogues, you use the dialogue library there. If you want a progress bar, still in beta, use that. If you want a rich text editor, like eBay has, for allowing users to type in non-HTML formatting, just grab that off the shelf. My God, I would not want to implement a WYSIWYG editor in JavaScript myself. That alone is a whole project. So you have some very nice features being provided. And let me go ahead and pull up YUI so that we don't come across as too biased. Let me pull up this one. I actually tend not to use Dojo. I find its documentation horrifically lacking, but it is popular. I just tend to have a low attention span or short attention span when it comes to figuring things out. So while their website is pretty at first glance, let's see. Welcome. Oh, demos. This is actually better. This was always my favorite. I haven't used this for anything. But I always thought it was cool that you could do something like this in JavaScript. It's one of those things that I think is actually a little annoying the more that you use it. But the fact that this is possible just by making a function call, essentially, and passing in the icons you want is kind of neat. So this speaks to the dynamism of JavaScript today and also is an interesting takeaway because many people or many sites think that you have to use Flash to achieve interactivity and smoothness like this. It's really not the case. And Google, again, sort of as a company, really uses Flash nowhere except Google Finance for charts and Google Earth for their new plugin for web browsers. For the most part, everything Google does is JavaScript and CSS driven, the upside of which is that it's a lot more portable than something that would be Flash-based. So that's presumably their motivation. And it's also much lighter because it's all just text, which can be compressed down very effectively. Is that a question? Mm-hmm, exactly. Absolutely, yeah. No, absolutely. So I would say that a final project should not be to implement the Apple-like dock like this, because clearly that's been done already. By all means, you should certainly build on the shoulders of what's the expression? Stand on the shoulders of others if you want to add yet more interesting components to your site. So Dojo has a bunch of things here. Another very popular one is, I never remember how to pronounce this, XJS? I think Wikipedia explains how to describe it. But this too. And realize, and I'll just wave my hands at some of these details, a lot of these entities have both sort of paid for, supported versions and free versions, EXTJS. Or XTJS is one such thing, but there's a community edition here on the left that one can use for such things. MooTools is another, and Scriptaculous was actually one of the first. They seem to be, in my own experience, among the less cross-platform, but all of what you just saw on the screen, no Flash. That's just JavaScript. And again, hints at the kind of fun you can have using this particular language, especially if you're using a library to do things like animation. So I'll pull up just a couple of examples here. Let's see. Animation framework. Yep. Okay. Combination effects. Let me see. Let me click this here. Combo effects demo. Okay, I'm back in the same place. So if you want, for instance, something to just fade away, it's kind of cool that you can do that. Or if you want something to kind of puff away, I'm not sure that's not blinds up. You see these things. So the point, if anything, is that it's very easy, actually, to make ugly websites using such things. But you certainly see these kinds of UI mechanisms on various websites. And again, it could take days to just get this right across multiple platforms. And that's the value of these libraries. Other people have paved that road for you. It's a good question. Thoughts on combining libraries? I would say, as a matter of principle, it's ideal to avoid for two reasons. One is just bloat, because some of these things are not particularly lightweight. You end up downloading multiple kilobytes to the user's browser, which is just more HTTP traffic, slower connections ultimately, and they don't all necessarily play well together. So I've been using YUI and one or two other libraries. I think jQuery together for certain things, but it always makes me a little nervous, because the various libraries sort of prefer to be autonomous. So I would just say beware doing things like that for both of those reasons. Other questions? No? It's great fun, and it's also a great distraction, because at least I find myself sort of ogling these various libraries and thinking, what problem can I solve using this, as opposed to actually going to them when I have a problem. So it seems just to create work for myself. But this too, actually, I don't know if I pointed this one out, but this too was just a fun use of someone else's API, very much in the spirit of final projects. I originally had a traditional tag cloud that I made with HTML on the right-hand side of this Twitter site, and what was outputted there was just a length of the most popular hashtags, as they're called, in the Twitter sphere. But I thought, wow, I saw this on someone's WordPress blog, and this is, in fact, a Flash animation, though it gracefully degrades back to HTML if people don't have Flash support, and it's literally a tag cloud. It's got a nice little 3D effect. Frankly, I don't think it improves the user experience particularly. It just looks kind of pretty. And I'm not sure who clicks on tag clouds anyway, so I figured why not at least make it look different. But this too, underneath the hood, is a Flash animation that I interface with using JavaScript. And the means by which I pass data into this Flash animation using JavaScript is I pass it an XML string that contains all of the various hashtags and the links that I want the user to be led to upon clicking it. So again, all of the basic building blocks we've been looking at in this course, to be honest. So it's fun to see it all come together. Questions? Yeah? If they don't support a particular API, is there a way to have them use a different one? Oh, you certainly could. So there are ways of detecting what browser a user has. But for the most part, to be honest, all of the APIs that I just listed tend to be, they are listed because they are so cross-platform these days. And most of them, all of them on the board at least, are under active development. Although Scriptaculous and Prototype have kind of begun to fall by the wayside, I would say, anecdotally, versus some of the others. So, and jQuery too is just not just syntactical. What jQuery has, just to round out the list here, if I search for jQuery site, they have their jQuery UI library. So at top right here, you'll see that there's this aspect of it. And if I click something like, let's see, browse all effects and widgets, draggable. So this is actually cool for some interfaces. If you actually want to have sort of a drag and drop interface, again, just implementing something like this, you could do it, and it'd sort of be an interesting bite-sized project assignment, but much easier just to grab something off the shelf. So, fun with APIs, and that's why we call our page Fun APIs. All right, so What more is there? So you'll nonetheless run in this JavaScript world, to various inconsistencies across browsers. So these libraries are meant to chip away at that. But, and I think I've mentioned this fellow's site before, this guy's site, quirksmode.org, has really done a good job at speaking at a very technical level to the various differences among browsers when it comes to what events various browsers support and what elements support those events, how you do certain things cross-platform using JavaScript. So if you're ever trying to chase down a fairly esoteric bug, whether it's for now or after the course, check out this site, FYI. He's got some tutorials, but also some really interesting analyses. This is sort of the type of person, it seems, who spends a lot of time in the evenings or on weekends just sort of thinking about problems that other people are plagued by, but really writing up their answers, not just solving it for himself. So a wonderful reference in this world. And now, getting your own code correct. So JSLint is a wonderfully useful tool, especially when you're starting to write lots of JavaScript code that you really need to be robust across multiple browsers. This is a tool. You go to it, you copy-paste your own JavaScript code, paste it in there, click JSLint, and you can also check various boxes to check certain things. So we won't dwell on all of the details here, but I would encourage you, before submitting Project 3, and not the night before, go ahead and paste your code in here. And it will nag you pedantically for certain things, like it tends to prefer that you use curly braces all over the place. So even if you just have an if condition with one statement below it, it'll prefer things like encapsulating that in curly braces just for being ever so clear what is intended, and making the code 100% parsable by all different browsers. So that tends to be a very good thing. And I'll just wave my hand at some of the checkboxes you can have here. This is a wonderfully good tool for just chasing down potential syntactic errors, much like the W3C's validator does the same for XHTML. Really no excuse not to use this, and it's sort of foolish for the course to throw away points because you didn't use a tool like this. In the real world, it's foolish to run into a browser problem just because you didn't run some extant tool on it. So keep that in mind. And related to that is, let me come to this one first, compressors. So we spoke briefly to this when talking about JavaScript last week and prior. There are ways of compressing or minifying JavaScript. I don't quite know why the verb is not minimize, but apparently the world uses minify. What this means is to take JavaScript code, which might be very well commented, nicely indented, variables beautifully named, just like one is taught in school, but it shrinks it down to the fewest characters possible, throws away all superfluous white space, changes all variables like foo, bar, and baz to x, y, and z, because the computer doesn't care, and the human shouldn't care if they maintain their original copy elsewhere and can simply recompress things later. So we actually use this for the current project. So I'll actually pull up cs75.net/news. If we pull this up, and it's perfectly fine for this project if you want to look at our HTML source and CSS. I mean, there's nothing intellectually interesting there. But notice we have this JavaScript file. So we really don't have much or any JavaScript code in the HTML file. This is index.html. It's nicely commented and such. But yes, there's an onSubmit handler there in the middle, and then a call to a function called Go. But we implemented Go in another file. So I'll go ahead and open mashup min.js. And what you'll see is this mess. So this is the JavaScript code that we, the staff, wrote to implement this. Looks completely cryptic, but that's intentional for two reasons. So one, this is much more compact. We're not wasting any bytes here, but also just because this is a course and because we want to raise the bar to folks just getting curious as to how we implemented this project, which by nature is client-side for the most part. So we still wanted to provide a sample solution, but it's a little too easy to look at the source code if we just put our sample solution out there, so we obfuscated it. And so these two sort of go hand in hand. We ran it through one of these compressors that takes in as input our original beautiful JavaScript code and spits out that obfuscated mess. So just as a disclaimer, you're welcome to glance at that, but trying to de-obfuscate that prior to submission of the project is a no-no per the syllabus. But among the tools here are there's JSMin, which you can grab at Douglas Crockford's site there, Packer, which is one we've used. You'll realize, and this is a common misconception, especially if it's the non-technical types mandating that you encrypt your JavaScript code or whatnot, Packer, that utility there, will actually encrypt your code. But it encrypts it by embedding the key in the JavaScript code, because that's the only way you can do this bidirectionally, encrypt and decrypt. So again, just per last week's discussion, it just raises the bar to your competition or to adversaries trying to copy your code or figure things out. It's absolutely reversible, but it just raises the bar. ShrinkSafe is another one, comes with the Dojo toolkit, and the YUI compressor also comes for free with YUI. The latter there is just a jar file. You run it at the command line if you've got Java installed, pass it as input, your JS file, and it spits out your compressed JavaScript code. Very easy to do, and it's really the last mile. Once your code is good and ready, you run it through a compressor if you care to, and then voila, you get the minified version, and that's what you include at the top of your HTML file or your PHP file or whatnot. Yeah?
Does the compressed code run any faster?
Good question. Does the compressed code run any faster? In theory, it should. Simply because there's less code to parse, but that's somewhat of an overstatement because it's not necessarily going to change the logic or the flow of your code. It's not a compiler. It's not going to find opportunities to optimize your own code. It's simply going to make it more compact. So you gain some benefits, and frankly, you lose some benefits if you then try to encrypt it, so to speak, with something like Packer. So with that said, and actually, I should have updated this. I did this slide a few days ago. So Google just released a toolkit called Clojure, which is a JavaScript compiler, which is actually more sophisticated than these things and actually does supposedly alter and try to optimize your code for more efficient execution. And this is a topic that's actually very much in vogue these days. The browser manufacturers are sort of running out of things to compare themselves against, and so now they're focusing on speed of JavaScript execution, which isn't a bad thing because almost any app we use these days is JavaScript driven. So it's really sort of the next place for client-side application development. So these tools, not so much. Google Clojure, which I've not personally played with yet because it literally was announced last week publicly, is something interesting to look at for that, especially for mobile devices whose CPUs are more limited. Yeah? Good question. Are there any disadvantages to compressing your code? Yes, you can break your code if you were a little lazy with your syntax. So one of the best reasons to use something like JSLint is because it will force you to write code that's really deterministically parsable and is really correct in accordance with the JavaScript spec. And as such, if you run your code through JSLint and then compress it, there's low, if any, probability of an error. But if you, for instance, are a little loose with your semicolons, with your parenthesization or things like this, it increases the probability, I would say, compressing it, that you'll run into a problem because it's really just throwing away syntactic sugar, white space and all of this, that might have been working to your advantage unintentionally. So be careful. Or just write better code. Be sure you're writing good code before you do it. Other questions? Okay. All right. So Google Maps. So we already started to tell this story of downloading or getting yourself an API key. The API key means you can just embed Google Maps on your website, and Google won't nag you for not doing so. So just FYI, if you copy the staff's code from this week in the lectures page, you can absolutely run it on your own domains if you want to tinker and tweak it. But odds are you'll start getting JavaScript alert windows saying API key not valid for this domain, something like that. No big deal. Register for your own. Delete ours from the HTML. Paste yours in, and you're, again, good to go. So what can you do with this API? So there's essentially these five major categories of things you can do with it. And one of the exercises for this final project, before the final project, is to be to understand this API, at least in part. So you're not going to have to understand the dozens of functions and classes that I skimmed through earlier by holding my spacebar down, but definitely the concepts. Not because it's a useful life skill to know Google Maps' API, but because it's actually representative of a very well-designed one. And one of the nice things about using this for the course is that it's a really nice API for learning JavaScript, because the documentation is really solid, the syntax they use is very much standardized, and it's a nice way of doing neat things while having a lot of the core work done by someone else, namely Google here. But again, Bing and Yahoo have their own if you prefer those vendors for whatever reason. So you'll be walked through some of these details by way of the online API documentation, which essentially has two types. There is the hand-holding, and it's not even hand-holding, it's fairly technical, but it's more of the hand-holding approach. Do this, do that, here's why you're doing this, here's how it works, and then there's just the reference documentation, that really long page I skimmed through earlier. So we'll point you at a couple of URLs, and you'll find that it's relatively easy to do certain things. Let me go ahead and open up a canonical example here, which is my map1.html. Let me go into tonight's source directory, map1.html. And this is pretty much extracted from Google's own documentation. It's their Hello World of Maps. So I'll zoom in on the salient parts here. Some of it's not that interesting. Like here is the script tag that Google told me to embed at the top of my page. Below this is just some JavaScript code that I wrote. So let's take a look at that. All right, looks like I have a load function. All right, let's come back to that now. Now that we see there's very little code to write, and just look at the bottom for a moment. So all it takes to get a Google map up and working in a given web page is a few very simple elements. One, on loading the page, you should call some function you wrote, like load, and that's the function we'll come back to in a second. On unloading the page, that is if the user closes the window, heads to another website altogether, you should call gunload, capitalized as follows. So again, recall that JavaScript is very case sensitive, so beware little things like that. And then I just need a placeholder. I need to create a div, as I've done here, which has an ID, in this case map. I stylized it in a certain way. I want it to be 800 pixels by 500 pixels. That could really be anything, my choice there. But what's important is that if you now look at my load function, which is the JavaScript function induced or invoked the moment this page loads, I first call this function if gbrowser is compatible. Kind of a long named function. I only have to call it once. The documentation told me to call it. That just returns true or false, is the current browser supported. 9 times out of 10 these days, the answer is going to be true, at least if you're using any modern browser. So that's not really a deal breaker in general. And then 2 lines of code is all it takes to start using a Google map in your site. And this is where things, frankly, I think get exciting, that it's this easy to do things. So I declare a variable called map. I then call the constructor gmap2. Second version of their API, calling the new operator, which gives me a new object. So you see a little bit of object-oriented syntax if you've not seen this before. And then I pass to that constructor, gmap2, a single argument, the element that I want to insert the map inside of. How do I get that element? Well, I gave it an ID already of map, so I call document.getElementIID of quote-unquote map. That returns to me the DOM object, the object in memory representing that div. I pass that to the constructor, and what Google does is it plants that map inside of that DOM element. The second line is the only other required line to use the Google Maps API. I call a method in object-oriented terms called setCenter, again capitalized as follows, map.setCenter, and then it takes two arguments. The first is a longitudinal and latitudinal point, so essentially an XY coordinates. Now, there is a class called glatlong, which is another constructor, and I simply have to pass into this two arguments, latitude and longitude, separated by commas. This whole then expression returns an object of type glatlong. It's a point, generally speaking, an XY coordinate. The comma then separates it from the second and final argument to set center, which, does anyone have a guess as to what 13 denotes? Yeah, the zoom level. So at Google supports, I think it's 17, maybe 19 different zoom levels right now with Google Maps. It means how far out can you go and how far in can you go when zooming. 13 is sort of the default, or it's pretty common, so I just chose 13. That's what the documentation told me to do, and that's it. You create the map, you tell Google where to center it by default, and voila, you get a Google map. So let's see what the end result is. We go back to our little example here. This is map1.html, and voila. I have a Google map that appears to be 800 pixels across by 600 down. It is centered on whatever the GPS coordinates are for Palo Alto, their latitude longitudinal points, and it is in fact draggable. Now I can't really do much, can't search, can't zoom, really doesn't do all that much, but it was relatively easy to get this basic piece in. So why don't we go ahead and take our 5-minute break here, and when we come back, we'll start building on top of this. Okay. So one quick mention before we tease with some more Google functionality are these debuggers. And I've pulled up Firebug multiple times, and I just wanted to emphasize, especially now that you're doing JavaScript heavy stuff, do not underestimate the utility of Firebug, which is a free Firefox plugin. It's the thing that allows me in Firefox, if I go to a website, to click this little bug icon and then pull up the script tag and actually navigate all of the CSS that's been downloaded to my particular page. What's nice, if you start to play around with this, I can scroll down, for instance, to a JS file like Google's, which is going to look a bit of a mess, so I'm going to have to choose something that's not obfuscated. Let's see. I guess I'll have to do my own, which is in here. If I scroll down, I can write, or I can just click on the side here with this red dot, and that means now I'm going to get a breakpoint at that line. So if I now reload the page and that line of code re-executes, execution is going to pause at that point, and then using some of these icons on the right-hand side, can I start to step through my code using the window on the right-hand side under the watch menu? Can I see the state of various variables and objects? So if you run up against a bug, frankly, start here first. Wonderfully useful, wonderfully free, and in particular, it's the console you're going to want to check first. So right now, if you pull up Firebug and click console, you'll see reload to activate window console. Here is where you will see, in red, error messages triggered by buggy JavaScript code. Syntactic errors will appear here. Unfortunately, most browsers, if you've got a JavaScript bug, they just don't do anything. You'll get a white screen, or your code won't appear to run, or you'll click submit, and it won't actually intercept the call. It will just send you to some other URL. So realize that this is the place to start. Wonderfully enlightening. With that said, Chrome has its own built-in debugger now. Safari has its own built-in debugger. I'm a little biased toward Firefox just because I kind of grew up on this interface. Though I will say, having tried both Chrome's and Safari's, I still prefer Firebug's interface. Feels to me like it works. It's a little more user-friendly. But use any one you want. Just use something. There's another one out there called JavaScript Debugger, also free for Firefox. This one, I would say, is not as good. This one has a habit of at least of crashing my whole browser. But in occasional situations where Firebug just isn't helping me, it's not telling me what the problem is, it can't figure it out, I have very often found that resorting to this sort of as my level 2 support, it reveals to me more enlightening error messages that Firebug, for whatever reason, isn't reporting. So realize that this is sort of someone you can escalate to, but again, it seems to crash or hog too much memory too often for my taste, so I stick with the first. All right, so with maps, we left off with a very simple example. Let me bring up one thing which is a common goal, and that is to implement something that actually fills the screen. So this is our implementation here. Notice what's kind of neat about the staff solution is that if you resize it, notice that the map grows to fill the screen. So unfortunately, this is not so easily done as it is said. So you might think that all you have to do is say height equals 100% or 80% or whatever it is, and things just work. That's actually not the case, because what will happen is the moment you insert more content above a div, like we have with the logo and the search box and the search button, all of a sudden, if I say that this map should take up 100% of the page, you start to get vertical scroll bars, because it will be 100% the height of the window, but the browser doesn't realize or doesn't care that there's 100 or 200 pixels also being taken up by this form. So what happens is you get a map that's 100%, but it's downshifted by 100 or 200 pixels, so you get the annoying scroll bars. But this is actually good for our purposes, because a nice bite-sized challenge as part of Project 2 is to make sure that your map does in fact scale to fill the page, at least within reason. We've intentionally left a border there, but that was just because we thought it looked pretty. You will at some point see a scroll bar because some of Google's own form elements, like the zoom feature, do require a certain height. So some scroll bar is actually okay, but once you exceed that, especially on large monitors, you want the thing to be able to grow sort of in perpetuity and resize automatically. But there's some very basic elements there. There's a window.resize event that gets triggered anytime a user clicks and drags the corner of the window like that. We're registering an event handler, a function that says, okay, the moment the window gets resized, let me clean some things up. What am I cleaning up? Well, using some JavaScript code or Yahoo libraries or jQuery libraries, if you even want to play with them for this piece, this project, that's fine. Can we figure out the whole height of the whole browser? The height of that form, and then we can have the map be the total minus the form's height. So very simple arithmetic in the end. So this is actually a nice little bite-sized example. Only takes a few lines of code. Might take some Googling to figure out the best cross-platform way of figuring out the height of a window or the height of an element. And there, too, libraries can help. So frankly, if you want kind of a kick in the pants a little earlier than the final project to go learn one of these libraries, this is a really good project for that, just to solve some of these bite-sized problems. So FYI with that. So let's see what happens with map2. So map2.html, almost identical, but I used a little bit of CSS here. So style elements on both body and div. And notice I've said my height should be 100 and my width should be 100. And there's another detail there, but I'll come back to that in a second. Let me go to map2.html. Again, you have printouts of all these tonight. This does fill my page nicely. Kind of feels a little more gratifying because this feels more like a real website. And notice I don't have scroll bar problems, but I don't have any other content on the page. So that's the hiccup you'll bump into when you implement your own project 3. But what I did have to do to make certain browsers happy is this thing. So height is 100%. Let me see what happens in Safari because it depends on browser. If I get rid of that design element and do this, an FAQ. Please don't ask this question on the bulletin board because we're answering it right now. When you say height is 100% for your map element, it will be 100% of the height of the containing element. The containing element for that div is the body, but the body, if it has no other content, really is 0 pixels high because the div element, whose ID is map, does not get filled with Google's map until the whole page has loaded. And therefore, your JavaScript code has run and starts to insert all of those map tiles into the map. So you kind of have this catch-22 where it's going to, well, that's the wrong analogy here. You kind of have a race condition, essentially, whereby you want the map to fill the screen. So you say 100%, but the screen is only as large as the map. So by default, the map is 0 pixels, so the whole body is only, the whole map is 0 pixels, so the whole body is only 0 pixels. So this isn't the case on all browsers, but at least with Firefox, if you don't specify that the body of your page has a height of 100%, that's precisely the behavior you'll see. And this isn't just with Google Maps. This is most any time you interact with the height of a page. Also notice I did the same thing on the HTML elements. So another FAQ, put 100% height on the height on the body and on the HTML element. Doesn't have to be in the HTML file. It can be in styles.css or the like, but notice that I have attached it to those two elements, and that's what made that work. All right, in the third version of this, I've finally gone about and added some controls to the map. Right? It's not a very interesting map without zoom and hybrid mode and satellite mode, all of which are kind of fun. So now notice I have this thing on the top left, that stuff on the top right. So I've overlaid the familiar Google Maps controls from the normal website. It's still mine. It still lives at my URL. I can click and drag, but now I can click satellite, and I can get this funky view. And frankly, there's something very gratifying, at least for me, about even though we've done so little, and Google has done 99.9% of the work, it's still my mashup, or it's still my web page. So the bar is set very low to entry with this particular API. So how did I add these things? Well, it's enlightening for us not because it's interesting intellectually to create zoom icons on a screen, but because it speaks to some more JavaScript syntax and API functionality. So here is my new version of load. This is map3.html. The first two lines are identical. In spirit, I instantiate the map with the first line of code. Then I center the map, this time not on Palo Alto, but on the Science Center. I Googled around. I figured out what the GPS coordinates were for Harvard Science Center over on Oxford Street, and I provided those as the arguments to this constructor here. Then, according to the documentation, there are these things called controls in the Maps API. Controls like the zoom feature and those icons in the top right. So I created a variable called type control. I instantiated something called gmap type control, and then I called a function map.addControl, and then I passed in this variable. And I just used two lines of code here. I could have technically done one, just for the astute who noticed that this variable is kind of useless overall. I just did it for a little bit of clarity here. I took this approach of a one-liner for this, g large map control. That actually gives me some of the button, that gives me the zoom thing on the top left. So the first lines of code did the thing at the top right. The second thing did the thing on the top left. And then finally, I can't simulate it here because I have a laptop. To enable the scroll wheel on a desktop computer, it's as simple as calling enable scroll wheel zoom, and then continuous zoom just does a more smooth zoom instead of something that's a little more jerky. So very simple syntax. And for our purposes, what's nice is that this is pretty canonical JavaScript syntax, at least if you're coding it from an object-oriented perspective, instantiating objects with the new keyword like that in the constructor, calling methods that are associated with objects. Those of you who have a background in Java or any object-oriented language, this should probably be a little more familiar. And if it's new to you, frankly, you can just kind of accept that we have a little bit of new notation now. When we call functions, sometimes we do object name dot function name, aka method. And that gives you a method associated with that object. So the end result is, again, just this thing. All right. So let's take things up one more notch. This is the fourth version of map, map4.html. And notice I've actually planted a marker. So I've ripped out some of the other code because it's now just a distraction. But I now have a marker that's planted on top of what appears to be Harvard University that, when clicked, gives me a little cartoon bubble. Didn't really give much regard to aesthetics here just yet, just in Times New Roman or whatever. But I have some bold-faced HTML and a hyperlink there that's clickable and leads to the Wikipedia article on the Science Center. So how did I do this? Well, this is map 4. Notice that my load function has changed a little bit more, and it's a little more sophisticated. And here's where we can introduce another feature of JavaScript here. So at the top, I again do the same thing. I instantiate my gmap. I then do a little something different. This time, I actually want to keep around a variable with the GPS coordinates in question, because I need to do two things now with these GPS coordinates. I want to center my map on the Science Center, and I also want to plant a marker at the Science Center's GPS coordinates. So hence the variable. I want to do two things. So I declare var point gets new glat long of the GPS coordinates of the Science Center. So now I have a variable that I can reuse. I set the center just as I did before, but this time passing in this variable called point. And then I have a little new feature here. I'm instantiating with this line of code something called the gmarker. This is in the documentation. I read the section about markers. It said call new gmarker stored in a variable, and so I did. And now you can actually think of a Google map as a base layer on top of which you can put any number of transparencies. And you can apply to these transparencies any number of objects, among them markers. There's other things, as an aside, called lines and polylines. So you can actually draw routes on top of the map. But think of that always as drawing on top of a clear transparency. So I call map.addOverlay, and that puts one of these transparencies on my base map. And this transparency contains a single marker at that location of the Science Center. So now, and here's where the syntax gets a little fun and very representative of elegant JavaScript syntax, I need to now register an event handler with that marker so that when I click the marker, something happens, namely the cartoon bubble comes up. So how do I do that? Well, I could do this almost entirely in my own JavaScript, but because one of the design elements comes from Google itself, the marker, I actually need to use their add listener function. So you may have seen me display YUI's add listener method before. jQuery has something similar. Because we're dealing with the marker object here, I'm using Google's own API. And you'll find that Google has a lot of utility methods that YUI and jQuery themselves have. But to your question earlier about mixing libraries, no need to add additional libraries if you can use one that already has this feature. So I call a method called add listener. This is in a utility class called gEvent. So gEvent.addListener takes three arguments. The first is the object that I want to listen for stuff to happen to. So that's going to be my marker variable. The second argument is the event I want to listen for. Click makes sense for a marker. Other events could be mouse down, mouse up, key down, key up. But for a marker, makes sense to care about clicking on it. So that's the event I put in quotes there. And notice it's just click. It's not on click in this context. And then the third and final argument is a function pointer. So JavaScript is kind of neat. In PHP, you can do this too, different function name. But you can create anonymous functions, otherwise called lambda functions. These are full-fledged functions that can be called. They just happen to have no name. So the reason for this in this context is I could define a function called foo or handler or whatever. But if this function is only going to get called once, just I'm sort of anal. I don't need to clutter my namespace by having variable names or function names that are only going to get called once. So this approach of using an anonymous function is a fairly common approach when you just need a function in one place. So by calling the word function, open paren, close paren, I'm saying create a function on the fly that takes no arguments. Here comes its body. The open curly brace says, here comes its body. And apparently this function does the following. It creates a long string of XHTML. complete with some bold facing, some line breaks, and a URL inside of an anchor tag. And then the only line of code that's really magical is this one. What I'm saying is when this function gets called, create a string of XHTML, and then call a function called map.openinfoWindowHTML. Where do you want to open this info window? At this point with this string of XHTML. So that one line of code is from Google's own API documentation. And what it means is that I'm just creating on the fly a string of XHTML. I'm passing it to this info window method. And voila, the moment this function is called, which is only going to be when the marker is clicked, per the previous line of code, will this code execute. So that's actually kind of neat. Now, as an aside, those familiar with JavaScript or with this term. This also, anytime you call the function, as an aside, somewhat technical aside, this also induces what's called a closure, which means essentially the current state of your world is pulled off of the stack and is this function here always has access to all variables that are in scope at this moment. So what this means is that if I wanted to plop down multiple markers at multiple points, I could not write code just like this. And again, this is a little more technical than we'll go into detail now, but if you ever, for project 3 or your final projects, are running into a weird bug where maybe you have a loop and you're using an API like this and you're planting multiple markers at once and for some reason they're all at the same location or they all have the same XHTML or something like that where they're all doing the same thing instead of 20 different things if you're iterating 20 times, odds are the keyword to ask us about is closure. Because this is a side effect of what we're doing here. And it's I won't quite go off on the tangent here yet other than to bring that up, and we may revisit it as the code gets more complicated.
The function is not a name, it's just a generic.
It's a generic function that means create a function here and return a pointer there too. My PHP has the same functionality. It's called create underscore function. You can do the same thing if you want to create a function on the fly. Other questions? Okay, so the fifth example is this one here. So let me scroll down. And what's a little neat about this one, oh, let me see if I have, oh, I forgot one piece of code here. Let me see if I can grab it. Let me do one thing, sorry. Okay, come. I forgot to steal a previous example here. Okay. So quote 3 is one we've used before. And now we're in 8 source. So let me go back into our lecture directory. You don't have a printout of this today, but you do from last time, which is quote3.php, which looks a little something like this. So this was one of our little programs that simply queried Yahoo Finance, taking in a parameter called symbol that then fetched from Yahoo Finance the stock quote for that particular symbol. So let's go ahead and induce a call on this thing. This is quote3.php. Let me go to that URL, which is quote3.php, enter. I get back nothing by default, but if I add question mark, symbol equals goog, I get back my price, my high, my low. I can do something else, Yahoo. Okay, so it seems to be working. So I now have a program that if I view its source is returning what appears just to be some XHTML. That's all. So now I have just something I can invoke via Ajax. So let me open my fifth example of Google Maps. And actually, let me spoil what we're going to do by seeing where we're going with this. In map5.html, notice I've again gone back to Palo Alto. I've again ripped out some features that are now a distraction, but I have a marker at the Palo Alto location. When I click this link, I'm going to get back dynamically a response, which is, am I going to get back a response? Oh no, damn it. Okay, I'm going to have to fake this part of the demonstration. So I forgot last week I changed our examples from XML to JSON. No, that's not true. That's not true either. Hang on one sec. Let me see. Google, yep, quote 3. Quote. I renumbered things. That's what it is. Okay, so I'll have to fix this for next time. Not a problem, because it's a teaser for the Ajax part. So, in a moment, one weekends. I will click this marker here, and what you'll get is another cartoon bubble, but what you'll get is not just a static string like Google and then the URL of its article on Wikipedia, like we did for the Science Center. Instead, you'll get back a floating point value, namely the current stock price of Google. It's not quite as interesting a demo after 4:30 and the market's closed, because the number does not change every time you click it, but in theory it would if you took a look at this link afterward. So how does this work? So I have to apologize that I didn't update. I renumbered the example, so quote 3 actually returns XHTML, as we just saw, but what this particular version of Map 5 is expecting is XML response, which you don't necessarily have to use, and JSON is actually a little simpler, but more on that next week. But let's take a look at the part of the code nonetheless. So again, my load function has been rewritten. I now borrowed some code from last time. I set the center. I created a marker. I added my overlay. And now, just to give you a teaser for where we're going with AJAX, this is what it's going to take to get back an AJAX response. I'm going to call inside of my add listener function call here, which again means I'm listening for a click on the marker. I'm going to call this thing gxmlhttp.create. So this is just a factory method, so to speak, that returns browser independently a AJAX supporting object. And again, more on this next week. Just a piece of library code that allows me to make an AJAX call. What is an AJAX call? Well, an AJAX call is simply the act of making an HTTP request from client to server after the original web page has already been downloaded. So you can see this in any number of sites. Those of you who use, for instance, Facebook, when you log in, you have this news feed now, and now there's this thing called live feed where you see your friends' status updates kind of in real time. Or if you only have a few friends, won't be so real, but if you have lots of friends, you'll see the window keeps growing and things come onto the screen. Well, any number of other sites do this. Twitter site does this, and lots of news sites do this as well. Well, what does that mean? It means you're downloading the original web page, which has some static content, presumably, that's not going to change very much. But then there's usually a subset of the page that's meant to change. And that's because the authors of Facebook or whoever have written some JavaScript code that on some schedule, every 10 seconds, every 30 seconds, every minute, whatever, pull the server and says, do you have new data for me? Do you have more tweets? Do you have more status updates? Or whatever the case may be. And if the server says, yeah, your friends have posted the following messages, the server can then respond with some XHTML, with some XML, or with something called JSON, JavaScript Object Notation, which is just a really succinct JavaScript representation of data. So the web server responds with this HTTP response. I now get the response, me being the browser, me being JavaScript. I have to somehow parse this response from the server, and that might be as simple as just grabbing the return value and showing it on the screen, just plopping it inside the result. Or it might mean actually navigating the data or searching it. And one of the best examples, or maybe most familiar examples, of a very AJAX-y type site is this one. If I want to get out of here tomorrow and go from Boston to SFO, I can click something like this, depart to 1110, search. And Kayak really forged the path here with AJAX. Literally what I just described is now happening before you. It was showing a little progress bar, which was just a neat little AJAX trick, or not even, little JavaScript trick. And then the window here in the middle was getting populated. And then anytime I click these controls, I may very well be hitting the server. And in fact, it looks like I am, because if you notice very subtly in Firefox here, my little icon thing starts spinning, which means it is in fact contacting the server. So it's not all being done locally in JavaScript. But what's happening here are JavaScript calls, because notice what is not changing about the page. Yeah, it's not refreshing. The URL has remained, whatever that means, the same throughout. So this is AJAX. So ultimately, that's going to allow me to do this very simple example with Google Maps, but that's the same idea for what you'll be doing as well with this piece. When we go to our own staff implementation here, there's essentially two big steps. When I type 90210, I hit enter, and as you'll see in the PDF, you'll pass that value to Google's geocoding service. They wrote some JavaScript code that takes a string as input, might be a city, a state, a zip. They then parse it using their fancy servers. They realize, okay, 90210 feels like Beverly Hills. Let me return to you the GPS coordinates of Beverly Hills and some other data. I can then do with that as I wish. What I really want to do, apparently, is call map.setCenter on Beverly Hills. Then you're going to make a request of your own server, cs75.net, or your own domain name, where you're going to have a PHP file that actually queries your database, because your PHP file is going to expect as input some GPS coordinates. GPS coordinates of the map currently in view. So this is a rectangle. And even though that's a little bit of a lie because the Earth is kind of curved, so this thing's a little bit distorted, very minorly, it turns out with the Google API, you can get the GPS coordinates of the, let me get this right, southwest corner and the northeast corner. So you get two XY coordinates for each side, and that gives you a rectangle. And using just those two values, you essentially have now a rectangle. So in our MySQL database that you will create out of that very large CSV file, you will essentially be able to ask, what cities are between this latitude and this latitude and this longitude and this longitude, and you'll get back some number of cities. And you'll see in the spec we only want the top five or fewer, if fewer exist. And then you'll then have to create for yourself a response in this PHP file that hands back to your JavaScript code the locations of those cities, like the GPS coordinates, and also the news articles. So some form of encoding for those. And we'll talk next week about the various encoding techniques you can use as well as in section. But one of the means of doing this is that thing called JSON, JavaScript Object Notation. But another is RSS, or just XML itself. You can come up with your own format. Now, here's the problem. It would be really nice conceptually and just technically if when the user clicked go, search for Beverly Hills, and I needed to get the news for the local cities, my God, Google News already exists. They accept requests that return XML. FYI, we can navigate XML using JavaScript. It'd be really nice if my mashup could just contact Google News directly. But this is a violation of something called the... Anyone know? What's that?
Cross-domain.
Yeah, and it's the policy at play is generally referred to as what? Same origin policy. So for security reasons, which work to our benefit for the most part, if you have a website and you have JavaScript code, you can make as many AJAX calls as you want from your code back to your server. What you can't do is make calls from your code in the client to an arbitrary server, which means your JavaScript code cannot, by law of the browsers today, make AJAX calls to Google News directly. So this PHP file I've been describing thus far has two purposes in life. One is to query the MySQL database and just to figure out what cities are proximal to the one you're asking about. But two, it's to serve as a proxy to Google News so that your proxy, your PHP code, will contact Google News for you, just like Yahoo Finance, just like you did with Yahoo Finance. You'll get the answer back from Google News in RSS format. And if you want, you can just send the RSS to your JavaScript, but you're going to be sending a lot of bloat in that case. You can just prune out the article names and the URLs most likely, but this PHP file will have to, by nature of this same origin policy, be a middleman. And we'll talk a bit more about that in our security lecture, but that's the reason for this proxy. And that's also the reason that in Project 2, you had to contact your own PHP code, namely your quote.php or whatever you called it, to actually contact Yahoo Finance. You couldn't do it, for instance, in JavaScript, even though we didn't push JavaScript in that project anyway. So what is RSS? Well, many of you probably use it. The spec is coincidentally hosted at Harvard itself, or at least the second version. RSS is really simple syndication or rich site summary, though the former is the more popular acronym expansion. And it looks like this. So it is an XML format. It's been standardized by various people, and any RSS feed has at least these elements. You have an RSS root element, you have a channel element inside of it, you've got some data about the title of the channel, the description, the official link for this channel, and then one or more item elements. Now, in general, an item represents a news article, or a blog entry, or a tweet, but people have begun to abuse RSS for many different things. Apple's own podcast directory uses RSS plus some special tags for podcasts, which is a bit of an sort of co-opting of the RSS format, but it's useful because other programs can understand the same files as well. So Google News and many, many, many sites encode their information in RSS, and per the final project teaser before, anytime you see RSS data out there, again, the geeks in the room should drool just a little bit because it means you can write code very easily, like you did for Project 1, that parses this stuff. And you don't have to resort to that thing called screen scraping, which generally is a mess. Because people change their sites, your code breaks. So this is a good thing. CSV files are wonderful. RSS files are wonderful. XML in general is wonderful. APIs like Google's even better, because then it's even more standardized. You write less code of your own. So keep an eye out for these things. So in the end, you will have a little mashup that looks a little something like this, but it doesn't need to look exactly like ours. And what we'll do next week is now stop taking for granted that people like Google have made APIs for us to facilitate these kinds of client-server interactions, and we'll roll our own versions of Ajax and actually see what more we can do with this technology. So Sid's section will be starting in half an hour, unless he can get in there sooner. But I'll stick around for questions. But otherwise, why don't we call it a night?